Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-ah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thanks for joining us on this Father's Day weekend. Well, I agree that we should minimize pollution where we can. I'm totally against this Green New Deal thing that suggests the world will be unlivable unless we change everything. Yes, they've been looking at electric-powered armored tanks for combat. That's nonsense. How do you refuel them? Hey, I'm 82 years old. I've heard the climate change nonsense for most of my adult life, and none of it has come true. In the 1960s, it was feared that the oil would be gone in 10 years. In the 70s, it was another ice age in 10 years. In the 80s, it was acid rain's going to destroy all the crops in 10 years. In the 90s, concern was that the ozone layer would be gone in, 10 years. And in 2000, it was global warming, and all the ice caps would be gone in 10 years. Literally none of that happened. Yet our military has to modify everything they do to avoid whatever the current crisis is. And this diverts attention and resources of the force that's supposed to be ready to protect us. We got to stop this nonsense. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. Skip, you and your family have been vacationing. Are you home and settled now, or are you still traveling?
Oh, we are home now, Colonel. We went down to Missouri. I visited five of my grandkids, my son, my daughter-in-law. Had a great time, you know. And my fifth wheel camper. We have a camper, and it's a 37 footer. It's a big thing. Always breaks. Every time I use it, it breaks. And this time, it was the black water tank. And if you don't know what that is, well,
you don't want to know.
Basically, it's a septic tank inside your house. And it was messy, but hey, we got the job done.
Hey, I'm proud of you, bro. I'm glad that I wasn't there, and because I'd be tempted to help you.
No, you wouldn't.
I'd be tempted. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's right. You're the sergeant. Get it done.
That's right. If you needed supervision, I'd have provided it.
Okay. Thank you.
Here's what we have for you today. A news and comments by the Colonel. I'm going to explain why I'm an extremist. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Nate Sassman will then discuss his time in the Army and his book, Warrior King. Then Colonel Sassman and I will discuss something our military seems to be really good at, how not to win wars. And former Special Ops guy Mike Vickers will discuss his book, By All Available Means. Of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on up to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
Well, we welcome your input to this show. Please send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or you can do it on Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel on Frontlines of Freedom. Of course, we'll start with the news. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel, over 100 retired U.S. Army Rangers signed a letter sent to congressional leaders to strenuously object to the defacement and desecration of the National Ranger Memorial. That's how those veterans described the decision to remove from the memorial the names of Rangers associated with the Confederacy. The May 23 letter the National Ranger Memorial Foundation sent to Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy and Representative Mike Rogers, Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, doesn't mention the names targeted for removal. But an April 28 letter, retired Brigadier General Joseph Stringham, the Foundation's chairman, sent to fellow Rangers, says Colonel Colin Mowell, Garrison Commander of Fort Moore, formerly Fort Benning, directed the Foundation to remove four names from the thousands on the memorial and the pavers leading to it. Confederate Colonel John S. Mosby, William Quantrill, George Bowman, Jackson Bowman. The directive is based on the September 2022 report the Defense Department Naming Commission sent to Congress recommending removing names associated with the Confederacy from U.S. military assets. The memorial, established in 1992, was constructed and is maintained solely by private donations.
As a retired Army Ranger, I totally oppose removing any names from that memorial. I also oppose the renaming of military posts. This unreasonable bias against men who fought to defend their states 150 years ago is stupid and unworthy.
And Germany is preparing to host the biggest air deployment exercise in NATO's history, a show of force intended to impress allies and potential adversaries such as Russia, German, and American officials. The Air Defender 23 exercise recently started has 10,000 participants and 250 aircraft from 25 nations responding to a simulated attack on a NATO member country. The U.S. alone has sent 2,000 Air National Guard personnel and about 100 aircraft to take part in the June 12 through 23 training maneuvers. Quote, "It will demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt the agility and the swiftness of our allied force in NATO as a first responder," U.S. Ambassador to Germany Amy Gutmanschi said. Quote, "I would be pretty surprised if any world leader was not taking note of what this shows in terms of the spirit of this alliance, which means the strength of this alliance. And that includes Mr. Putin," she added, referring to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
"This is a very important thing for NATO to do right now. Putin has to see that other nations do not accept his invasion of Ukraine or his aggressive attitude, and they see him as a criminal. It's especially important that Germany is playing a big part in this, as Germany had been getting pretty cozy with Russia."
And China and Cuba have reached a secret agreement for China to establish an electronic eavesdropping facility on the island in a brash new geopolitical challenge by Beijing to our nation, according to our officials familiar with highly classified intelligence.
"I guess flying balloons over our nation wasn't enough, even though we let the last one cross most of our nation doing whatever it wanted to do. And China is making deals with nations all over the world to gain influence as they seek to become the world's number one superpower, and as they work to show the world how weak and incompetent that we are. Do expect things to get worse."
A grainy black and white gun sight video Russia released this month to bolster a claim its military blew up some of Ukraine's most fearsome tanks actually documented the destruction of a tractor, according to a visual analysis by the Associated Press. The Russian embassy in Washington announced that its forces had annihilated 8 German-made Leopard tanks, among the most advanced and powerful weapons NATO countries have provided to Ukraine. The Russians then posted a video on social media with text saying it showed footage of the destruction of foreign armored vehicles, including Leopard tanks. Russian state-controlled broadcasters said it was recorded from thermal imaging system of a Ka-52 Alligator attack helicopter. Several black silhouettes of vehicles can be seen before the helicopter launches a guided missile that strikes one, causing it to explode. Germany announced earlier this year it would provide 18 Leopard 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine, which hopes to receive about 100 donated by various NATO countries. The Leopard 2 is one of the most maneuverable and highly armored battle tanks in the world, featuring a 120mm gun capable of slicing through Russia's Soviet-era tanks from more than 2.5 miles away. The visual analysis by the AP shows that the vehicles seen in the video, which was recorded at night, appear to be large pieces of stationary farm machinery parked in a field, specifically a self-propelled sprayer and 2 combines used to harvest corn and wheat. The vehicle struck by the Russian missile has 4 large wheels and sits high off the ground. Leopard 2 tanks are low-slung and have treads.
I wonder if the Russian official who approved the promotion of this video was just ignorant or really stupid. If the AP can figure this out, one would expect that the Russian government could do so. It's clear that Russian leadership is, well, lacking. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in getting involved in getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check CV4A.org. That's CV4A.org. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll talk with Colonel Nate Sassman about combat in the Middle East. At ease, troops, take a break.
HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with all of your everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, health-related services, or information on retirement planning, financial resources, or more, Our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all of your daily needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net wants to thank you for your service, and may God continue to bless the U.S. of A.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coriel with your Home Defense Tip of the Week. I'm often asked, at what age should you start teaching your kids about guns? There's no magic age, as all kids are different. The most important thing is to teach them gun safety. Teach them never to touch a gun unless mom or dad are supervising. And always keep your guns locked up in a quality gun safe where kids can't get to them. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you are in formation listening to the Front Lines of Freedom all across America. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. Folks, I hope it's clear that our goal in Front Lines of Freedom is not to try to tell you what to think, but to give you topics and ideas and some facts to think about as you draw your own conclusions. Okay, given that, I need to confess to you and tell you that I'm an extremist, and I'll tell you why. I realized I was an extremist when I saw the list of groups that the Southern Christian Law Center called extremist. And it turns out that I agree with many of them. I've concluded that extremists are about the only people we want in our military because we need people who love our nation and want to live by our laws and stand up for our nation's longstanding culture. Now, it's not only extremists who can fight. I grew up in Glendale, California, a Los Angeles suburb, and I saw a week or so ago in Glendale some anti-extremists physically attacked a bunch of parents who showed up to express their preferences to their school board. The parents must have been extremists for wanting to have their elected school board members do what they were elected to do. You know, I think that electing people and then holding them accountable is how our nation was designed to exist. It appears that anti-extremists only like to attack people who are not fighters. Sort of a cowardly thing to do, in my opinion. Men and women who join our military need to be focused on fighting only those who are armed and want to fight us. At least that was true when I was in the Army, and I think it's still true. Oh, and I'm one of those who feel that our nation's borders should be secure and that illegal aliens should not be allowed in. And if found in our nation, they should be immediately deported. We have laws that provide the procedure to enter our nation lawfully. We are a constitutional republic, that is, a nation of law. We must enforce those laws. Our present situation is that we are experiencing an invasion by people who do not respect our laws and who work with the Mexican cartels to get here. They bring nothing of use to this country, and we need to support them financially once they arrive. And they are certainly not the kind of people who will make good police or military people, as they are intentional lawbreakers. And why would we expect them to change? I grew up in an America that was founded on the principles established by the Judeo-Christian faith. Structured by our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, our country produced men and women who breathed the air of a free and just society. We were taught to appreciate the men who fought and died so that we could live free from the tyranny of a repressive dictatorship or a modern form of communism. Our country wasn't and isn't perfect, but it was and is the freest and most productive nation on earth. Pretty radical, huh? Well, things sure have changed. It seems every major principle that our founders held dear have been trashed by some so-called leaders. The lure of socialism has seeped into our culture, poisoning our children by challenging our rich history into believing that our nation was founded on evil principles. Critical race theory, pitting one race against another, is foolishly being presented as a solution to racial injustice. All CRT is a Marxist ideology that thrives on hatred and divisiveness. We stopped judging people by the color of their skin generations ago, and CRT is bringing it back. That's evil. Even though CRT has been forced on our military, all it has done is weaken our military's ability to defend us. Further, we need to get rid of government overregulation and the idea of welfare for all. Our nation became great because citizens worked hard to achieve success, not by sitting around waiting for the government to take care of them. Welfare should be very temporary, giving people a hand up to pull themselves up to self-sustainment, not a handout they can live on forever. Okay, truly handicapped people are an exception. Welfare puppies will never make it in our military. And men who decide to call themselves women and can use the women's showers and locker rooms and compete in women's sporting events? and encouraging young children in school to reconsider their gender and setting them up for surgery, often without even consulting their parents? This is both insane and evil. By the way, children belong to their parents, not to the school or the government. I have zero understanding of how this can be happening. And our criminal justice system is a disaster. We have prosecutors who don't prosecute criminals and release repetitive offenders on their own recognizance. What's the result of this? Exactly what you'd expect. Increased crime, particularly felonies. This has logically driven more good citizens to buy firearms and take training in their use because they know they must defend themselves. And I forgot to mention how we treat police officers. Police officers, like military folks, are imperfect, but really good people who put their lives on the line to protect we citizens. Yet, when they do so, they're called names and blamed for all kinds of things. And yes, there are fewer police today, because who wants to work in that kind of environment? Major cities are having huge problems with citizen safety. In the 1990s, New York City was having real crime problems, so they started arresting everyone who committed even a minor crime. This enforcement of minor violations drove down felonies and made New York City one of the safest cities in the nation way back then. This concept's been abandoned. Don't you wonder why? I do. Then there's the unlimited bias of most media. It's one thing for the media to favor one side politically when they report on an issue. You can always look up more information if you want. But when they don't even mention something, you know, like the investigation into crimes by the sitting president and his family, that's totally manipulative. Here's my biggest fear. Why did the Roman Empire collapse? It corroded from within because the people in charge became obsessed with power and money. This corruption couldn't sustain an empire that ruled half the known world at its peak. The empire drained its citizens with high taxes and eroded loyalty. The military became undisciplined under failed leadership. And it appears that's what we're doing now. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and we get to enjoy some more wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have this week, Roland?
You know, the United States wasn't the first country to develop a jet-powered fighter aircraft, but it was definitely the first in which a pilot flew wearing a gorilla mask and a derby hat while holding a cigar. It seems the test pilot for what would become the Bell P-59 era Comet had a pretty robust sense of humor. Sadly, not everyone got the joke, especially those who didn't know what the P-59 was. All they saw was a mysterious, fast-moving aircraft flown by a comical gorilla in the skies over a secret aircraft testing area in the middle of World War II. If you think about it, it's actually not that bad of an idea. If you're flying a top-secret experimental aircraft in the middle of the day when other pilots are in the air, it makes sense to help create a story so outlandish that no one on the ground would ever believe it. In 1942, the Bell P-59, which was the United States' first jet-engine fighter aircraft, took to the skies for the very first time. It was America's entry into the race for an operational jet-powered fighter for use in the war. Britain's Royal Air Force was already a year into developing its fighter, and Nazi Germany had been testing one since 1939. Bell's aircraft's senior test pilot was Jack Woolens, a veteran of the U.S. Army Air Corps, a fearless record setter, and renowned practical joker. Had he not died in a post-war plane crash in 1946, he would have been the first person to break the sound barrier in the Bell X-1 rocket plane, instead of Chuck Yeager. Woolens tested a number of aircraft for Bell during World War II, but none of the planes he tested would see service with the United States. Most Bell aircraft ended up in the Soviet Air Force, where prop-driven planes like the P-39 era Cobra were used to decimate the Germans on the Eastern Front. The P-59 era Comet, however, was never going to end up in the hands of the USSR. Its existence was a closely guarded secret, one that only the British knew about because they lent the US their jet engine designs. In order to keep it secret, American airmen would use some pretty creative deceptive tactics to dupe outsiders and potential spies who might be looking for anything unusual on the flight line. The era Comet was often fitted with a fake propeller on its nose so it wouldn't stand out while taxiing. Woolens' practical jokes on the ground continued even while he was in the air. While flying the only jet aircraft in the skies over the United States, a plane no one else in the air even knew about, he would join formations of propeller planes wearing the gorilla mask and derby hat and holding a stogie. It's important to remember that pilots had a pretty good view of one another at this time in aviation history. In the sight of a gorilla flying a plane with no propeller, which pilots believed was necessary for flight, must have been more than just a little surprising. The P-59 era Comet would ultimately never be used in combat. Germany and Britain were the only countries of World War II whose jet fighters became operational during wartime, but it came way too late to affect the outcome of the war. Still, its speed and maneuverability made piston engine planes obsolete. By the time the U.S. entered its next major conflict, the skies over those battlefields would be dominated by jet engines. For Frontline to Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Thanks, Roland. That was fun. Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss his Army career and book with Colonel Nate Sassaman, and then Nate and I will discuss how not to win wars. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Start with 50, take a break, do another 50, then stand at ease.
Friends, Adam here, Patriot Foods, U.S.-only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer when you shop at PatriotFoods.com. We give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off PatriotFoods.com. 10% off promo code FREEDOM and shop today.
Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome to the show a fellow West Pointer and combat infantryman, Nate Sassaman. While Nate and I both played football at West Point, I played intramural while he was a starting quarterback, took Army to a bowl victory. Okay, we both did command infantry troops in combat, me in Vietnam, he in Iraq, but he made a decision that his boss didn't like. I'm always happy to have a brave combat leaders who took care of their troops on the show. That's Nate. Welcome, Nate. Glad you could join us.
Hey, sir. Thanks for having me. I appreciate all you're doing here with Frontlines of Freedom. It's an honor to be here.
Nate, let's start at the beginning. Why did you want to go to West Point?
Yeah, you know, that's a great call. It really was all centered around football at the time, sir. And I was recruited heavily by Air Force, and you know, they ran an offense that my high school ran pretty close to it. And then Army started recruiting me. And so then when I went for the visit, you know, you step on the campus of West Point and it's just so awesome. And it left an indelible mark. And I knew I wanted to be part of the long gray line and part of the tradition and hopefully get to play a little football there too.
And apparently they did let you play football.
They did. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of an up and down career. We don't talk too much about the first 3 years, but when Coach Young changed the offense to a wishbone offense and I was able to compete for the quarterback job for my senior year, everything kind of fell into place. And then we had this amazing year, but you know, prior to that last season, there were some pretty, you know, pretty difficult, challenging situations.
Well, you know, that sounds like life, doesn't it?
It sure does. So yeah, and I think we just kind of got to a point where at least I know amongst the seniors, we were like, we're just going to lay it all out there and go with it. And you know, kudos to Coach Young. There's not too many leaders and coaches that will scrap what they've been doing for a decade or so and go to a whole new strategy, a whole new offense that suits the talent and the people that you have.
You know, we're going to be talking about leadership, and I guess you already started talking about leadership. One important question. Did you guys beat Navy?
We did beat Navy, and we beat them with a stick. It was 28-11, and we were never behind. And thank goodness, sir, because you know if you don't win one of those, it's tough talking about it for the rest of your life as a football player.
Hey, we lost all 4 years. I was a cadet. So
yeah,
okay.
I know.
Okay, so you saved us. Okay, that's cool.
We got one. I got one.
Okay, you got commissioned infantry. Where'd you serve? Talk about your early.
Yeah, you know, I started out in the light infantry at Fort Ord, California, in the 7th Infantry, both with the 232 Buccaneers and the 327 Wolfhounds. We did a lot of deployments into Central America at that time. So this is the late 80s. It was an awesome experience. And then obviously the advanced course, and I, I commanded both up at Fort Lewis in 9th Infantry Division and then down at Fort Polk, Louisiana, as a, believe it or not, ghost troop 2nd ACR that they were bringing back from Germany in the huge reorganization there early on. And then went off to graduate school and worked in the admissions office at West Point for 3 years, and then off to CGSC, and then served my major time at Fort Carson in 112 Infantry, and then was also the Brigade 3 for 3rd Brigade, 4th ID. Went over to Korea and worked in the SINCS initiatives group there for a year, and then really essentially came back for 2 weeks, had a short break with the kids and my wife, and then headed off to Iraq and took command in Iraq on 17 June 2003.
Okay. This is Colonel Denny Gilliman, Frontlines of Freedom. We're discussing the career of Colonel Nate Sassaman. Nate, let's talk about your assignment to Iraq in 2003. One thing I want to bring up, because I don't think you will, that's personal acts of bravery. I know that in August 2003, when your patrol came under attack, you braved machine gun fire and RPG fire to drag one of your wounded soldiers from his vehicle. Then you chased down the insurgents, killed or captured them all.
Yeah.
You know, in combat, our responsibility is to lead and direct fire and maneuver, not take actions ourselves. But sometimes the right thing to do is to act yourself. And you apparently were in one of those situations.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that I've already exposed that, talk to us about your time in Iraq.
Yeah. You know, that particular situation was the vehicle right in front of me. And so it was kind of like, I was always dismayed that we, you know, you had to patrol, I thought, you know, in at least platoon size elements, because many cases when the attacks would come, you know, then you just kind of like set up the perimeter and take care of the wounded and KIA. And I was like, we got to have enough force to, you know, to go after and eliminate the threat. And so my time in Iraq, I really philosophically, I was all about engaging with the Iraqi people, but a lot of it depended on whether they wanted to have the dialogue and work on, you know, some of that rebuilding piece, or if they were going to engage us with weapons. And I was a firm believer, I've always been a firm believer to crush the ant with the sledgehammer. And if we, you know, you attacked Americans and wounded or killed them, then I was going to do everything in my power as a infantry battalion commander to make sure that was your last day on the face of this earth. And I guess that's kind of the way, that's kind of the way I operated. I was, you know, I was all about helping to rebuild, but I was also about eliminating the violence against the American forces.
Well, you know, I was a company commander and a platoon leader in Vietnam. And my goal was, one, I want to accomplish my mission, but two, I want to bring my guys home safe. And you don't do that by being nice to people that are the enemy. And sometimes that's not a popular thing among higher people, brass, but it, when you're with the troops, you got to take care of them. And frankly, I think that one of the reasons we have an army anyway, the military, is to kill people and break things. And if we're really good at it, nobody will mess with us. That's called deterrence.
Right. Yeah,
that's the same thing you were doing. It's the same thing I was doing. If we're really tough, the bad guys will stay away or die.
Yeah.
That's why we're there, wasn't it?
Yeah. The enemy will always follow the path of least resistance. And so, you know, you wanted to be able to, like, you know, not only have a visual deterrent, but you needed to be able to back it up then with the firepower and the maneuver as well. And the challenging thing in Iraq was, and maybe you saw this a little bit in Vietnam too, was how the civilian populace was so afraid of the terrorists, you know, the different guerrilla factions that we were fighting, you know, instead of us. And so, I'll be the first one to say we kind of rolled with a heavy dose of fear and intimidation, because I was trying to get everybody to, like, hey, we're not coming here to, like, occupy your country and be here forever. We really want to kind of give you an opportunity to decide whether, you know, what you want the next type of government to look like. But we're here on a mission. We're certainly going to accomplish it. And then you're right, sir. It's all about taking care of your force. And after you have your first killed in action and your first several folks wounded, you know, that really hits home. And then life gets real simple. It's execute, complete the mission, and get everybody back home.
And if you were a soldier, and you were, isn't that the kind of guy you want to work for? I mean, come on.
I certainly identify with that. And, you know, and my, you know, the commanding general, you know, General Odierno, that was, he was a fairly aggressive division commander. And so there was, you know, we had resources to execute our mission. But, you know, again, and it's in the book too, I talk how each battalion was kind of using its, you know, was in a different demographic and they were using different tactics. We weren't like kind of every unit was kind of different in how they saw the, you know, how they saw the war and then how they prosecuted the fight. And where I came from and my background, it was, you know, I'm over here to win. And this is, so we're going to patrol. We're going to get out and, you know, take care of our folks, but we're going to accomplish our mission and we're going to use violence to do so.
Yes. That's what we were there for. There's more to discuss about Colonel Sassaman's deployment, and he's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Yeah, it's push-up time. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do, well, most days, some days. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
We were instrumental in passing the VA Mission Act so more veterans could have options and freedom in their health care.
We are leading the charge to end America's endless wars, bringing thousands of troops home and stopping trillions of dollars from being wasted.
Our key to success?
You. We bring your voice to leaders calling the shots so we can all have a better future. We are Concerned Veterans for America, the voice of veterans for freedom and prosperity.
Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to Veteran Veterans Program's mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Front Lines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Colonel Nate Sassaman about his combat in Iraq. Nate, tell us about the things that you were required to do in Iraq. First, combat-wise, you were talking about that as we went off. And second, the non-combat duties that you had to do. Talk about both those.
You know, in my particular, fairly large area of, you know, area of operations, roughly 750 square kilometers. It included the large base at Anaconda. So that was the theater commander's kind of like supply deal. That was number one. And then securing route one was probably number two. And then eliminating any kind of violence or, you know, determination by our foes to attack American forces was number three. And so, we spent a lot of time on battle drills because the enemy really used a lot of what I would call, you know, small mortars to attack the base. Rarely did they attack direct, but we were outside of LSA Anaconda, a logistics support area Anaconda. We were the ones kind of running all the patrols and securing that base. But every time it got mortared, there was a call from General Sanchez wanting to know, you know, what the heck's going on up there. And we got some battle drills down pretty quickly with our Q-36, Q-37 radars where we could return counterfire within 100 seconds and eliminate the threat. And it just took, you know, it's training. It's training, sir. You know this. It's reps. You got to practice it. And good units training combat. I've always believed in that. So when we weren't out patrolling, we were in our different bases, in the shoot houses, firing our weapons, getting the equipment maintained. And it was just, you know, I just felt like that was, we needed to be on, you know, every day, whether we were outside or inside. But those were the big pieces, was securing route one as best we could. And that was kind of the wild, wild west, that four-lane highway that runs north-south and throughout that country. And then the big base, and then dealing with any kind of attacks against any American forces in my area of operation.
And one of the things in your war is there effectively there was zero enemy in uniform where you could identify them as enemy soldiers, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, sir. That was pretty difficult. And I think early on, I think most of the dumb ones went away. We took care of them pretty quickly. And then you were dealing, as time went on, and I'm sure you saw this in Vietnam, the enemy was just getting smarter and smarter and using different tactics. And so we had to continue to evolve to stay ahead of them and keep them off. But you're right. There's no uniforms and there's no front lines. It's a 360 fight. And whether you're driving a Hemet or you're carrying a rifle, you're a target in that kind of environment.
Yes, sir. And the enemy's smart too. They learn what we're doing. They learn what works and what doesn't work. So yeah, there's even some parallels to football, isn't there?
There are. Yeah. And you know, and you saw this too. I mean, some of these things are basic, but it's like, don't take the same route back that you went out in, whether you're patrolling on foot or vehicle. And you know, the enemy is always looking for patterns and they're looking for ways to break down the good order and discipline of your unit. And so, you know, we had to get really disciplined in following some rules and procedures so that we didn't fall into those traps of complacency.
So while you're doing this combat, you also had non-combat responsibilities, consulting with, working with, helping rebuild the country, helping rebuild the community, the school system, the city council. Talk about that.
So I always just like to say, you know, we're doing a lot of combat operations at night. And then during the day, you know, we're doing these non-combat type of operations where we're engaging with the civilian populace, you know, and trying to stand up the city council and trying to get the schools open so that both the males and the females are being taught over there and just getting things kind of back to normal, because there was this like 90 to 120 day break where everything stopped. And I think everybody was just looking around like, what's going to happen? And I did have several, you know, civil affairs units attached. You know, there was kind of a loose, I think, civil affairs plan, but there was also a lot of just, I don't know, individual civil affairs unit just running all over the battlefield, doing all different kinds of projects. And, you know, if you see it in my book, one of the chapters, I just titled it Spend Money. And I felt like I think we could have done a little bit better job of tying in the rebuilding of the country a lot quicker and a lot more efficient. But at the time everything was really more focused on the combat operations. And then we were just doing our best with this other part.
Well, that makes sense to me, because as a company commander and platoon leader in Vietnam, that totally consumed me. That doesn't mean I did sleep, I did relax, I did talk to other people, but I needed that rebuilding time. If you had added in work with the city council and stuff like that, I think, well, I don't know what I would have done. It never occurred to me to have to do that.
Yeah. But then you run into the conundrum here of, I would be working with the city council in the afternoon during the day. And at night we would run an operational raid on a target. And guess who's one of the folks that we're detaining and capturing?
Yeah.
It's somebody from the city council I was talking with just that day. And so it was just crazy.
Well, it makes you wonder why you're spending time with the city council if they've got those kind of people in it. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Colonel Nate Sassman. Nate, you then acted to take care of your troops, and you got in trouble for doing it. Take a minute and talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, it was a tough deal. And it was, you know, it was right after the Abu Ghraib scenario, you know, in January of 2004. So there was a lot of attention on, you know, detainee abuse. And I had one of my groups, you know, walked two detainees and had them jump into the Tigris River up to about their knees. And I remember, you know, looking at both the platoon sergeant, platoon leader going, you know, seriously, guys, seriously. But he said, sir, you know, the lieutenant's like, sir, they got out and we watched them walk away. But from there, you know, they didn't follow the procedures. And let's be straight up. And so there was, a movement there to go ahead and court-martial the two soldiers and the platoon sergeant, the platoon leader. And then things got a little crazy because they also, I think there were some folks out there that would have liked to have seen my battalion executive officer and myself in that whole scenario too. And it was just really hard for me, without any conclusive proof or evidence, for me to just walk these four, you know, the officer, the NCO, and the two soldiers off the gangplank. And I just was, and there was some undue influence involved here too, but you know, it's a messy, you know, people are like, you come back to the States and you go through court martials in the nice dress uniforms. It can't replace how messy combat is. And these young people have been having to make really hard decisions. And I think over the course of the year, you know, that was a bad call. Was it criminal? I never felt like it was criminal. Was it a bad call? And should they have been disciplined? Surely. Should they have had to go to Fort Leavenworth for a decade? I don't think so. So it's one of those pivotal moments in your career where you just got to make you got to kind of take a stand. And that's where I took my stand.
You know, and you've got to do that if you're going to live with yourself and if your people are going to maintain that respect. Okay, you got a book out. We need to cover that. It tells your story. The title's The Warrior King. How can people buy a copy?
Well, there's this young guy named Jeff Bezos started this book company out of a garage in Seattle, and I think he's doing okay with it. But probably the easiest way is to go on Amazon.com and type in the title Warrior King or type in my name, Nate Sassaman, and I think it's going to pop up for you.
And it basically is your story with a lot more detail than we could have gone through right now.
I think I just kind of laid out. I mean, it is a leadership book, and I try to put the reader in my shoes as best I can. And I'm going to take you through the good, the bad, the ugly, and the really ugly of combat. And genesis of the book really came out once I came back. My neighbor, who is a 77-year-old woman, kept talking about all the news reports from Iraq. And I was going, no, none of that seems right. And I was like, and then I had a couple of people say, well, you really should write a book, Nate, because it was kind of like, you kind of were like Tom Cruise in like a war movie. So except that it wasn't a movie. And so was the genesis of it. But just the way I teach, I use a lot of stories. There's a lot of leadership principles in the book, but it's all around stories, actual stories of the good, bad, and ugly of combat.
And I certainly recommend it to you. Nate, thank you. Thanks for discussing your time in uniform. And thanks for sticking around so that we can continue discussing how not to win wars, since you and I both fought in wars that we didn't win.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thanks for having me on Front Lines of Freedom, sir. It's an honor.
This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour, continuing our talk with Nate. Then Special Ops guy Michael Vickers will present his book, By All Available Means. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for pull-ups. Do 30 good ones, grab some protein, rehydrate with water, and finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.